Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. An academic and DJ, Oliver Wang.
How's it going, Guy?
I'm doing very well. Oliver, on this week's show, look, it's been a complex week.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to remove ourselves from the world that we live in and visit other magical worlds for a bit of respite. This week, we're going to be talking about fantasy on the show. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or event caught our attention this week. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So I don't really have a conventional thing. I think, you know, in our lead up in discussing this as a group as to what do we want to talk about this week, I mean, I don't want to speak collectively for the group, but I think this was a really, really difficult week to figure out because we're all dealing with our own individual and collective emotions around everything that's happened in Baton Rouge and is it Forest?
They were
Falcon Heights.
It was Falcon Heights, Falcon but Heights, I think they were saying Anthony police officers. Yeah.
Right. And then in Dallas and just the general shit show that is America. Yeah. And I mean, compounding all of this for me personally is that I've spent from last Wednesday through Sunday night, I was in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall, literally down the hill from the Hill for four straight days as part of the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, which was really cool to participate in. But it was a really just bizarre and unsettling time to be in the nation's capital when you feel like the nation itself is really just going to hell. And I want to try to create some clarity in my rant here, but I think for me, with the point at which I've hit, and we can hopefully agree that 2016 has been just a freaking terrible year.
Absolutely.
And in terms of just the amount of frustration and rage and anger and depression and sadness and tragedy that and frustration, I think for me, what is really getting to me is not even just the, I mean, it's obviously the events themselves, but the feeling of the utter predictability of everything that happens is that a black man is shot and killed by police without justification, and you already know exactly how everything unfolds from there. The mainstream media, and God, I feel like I'm on Fox now or something, but the mainstream media is going to release, you know, the fact that he got a traffic ticket 3 years ago and make it sound as if he'd been arrested for felony assault. You're going to have, you know, Twitter's going to blow up. There's going to be pushback in one direction and then a response to that, but it all plays to almost script to the point where you just feel like you just keep going in circles and circles and circles. And I guess if one had to pull something positive out of this is that we can only do this so many times before something else happens in a different direction. And maybe that's Dallas and maybe it's other stuff, a little bit more constructive. I don't know.
I mean, the other light on this is that this shit has clearly been going on for like a while that as a white person, I wasn't exposed to. And the fact that one of my friends once suggested that whoever invented the camera phone should be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and win it. Because it is changing politics. It is changing the enforcement of law. And to just have this cycle run over and over again of seeing people not doing anything and then being murdered by the police and having white people have to run through all of their very good reasons that it might have happened and finally run out of them and have to understand that a thing that doesn't affect them is going on in this world.
The thing is, Guy, I don't see peace. I see all pretense of due process being thrown out when a suspect is – when they send in a robot bomb to kill somebody. I mean, it just astounds me that seems like the most clear violation of due process possible. Mm-hmm. And we blink as if that's just the new normal now, which it probably will be. I mean, we're probably weeks away from a domestic – this was a domestic drone strike. This is exactly what it was.
It was real terrible. Like the minute this happened, I was like, when are they going to tie this to ISIS the way that we tied Black Panthers to Moscow? Mm-hmm. Like, when are we going to start – making this a national security issue where even further abrogation of civil rights is just cool.
Right. And for me, I think if I had been home, I might have found other ways to sort of deal with it. Maybe it was going down like the Facebook, Twitter, you know, rabbit hole. Actually, I don't know. That probably would not have helped at all. But I was in D.C. on the Mall for four straight days while all this shit's happening. And I can't escape the Capitol building, which is looming right behind me. And yeah, I just got feelings. I got feelings about it, and I don't know how to work it out. I certainly don't know how to work it out through pop culture. I did watch The Lobster on the flight back. We can talk about that whole other time, but Winter, I blame you for this. But anyways, But yeah, it's been a weird week. I guess that's really the succinct way of what I'm trying to say. But if this year keeps going like this, I don't even know. I don't even know what I'm trying to say at this point. Like, yeah. I'm speechless in my just whatever.
Yeah. Margaret, you got thoughts?
Oh man. Well, I think that the main thing I tried to do for myself in just digesting this horrible news from every which direction was to try to watch as much original, unarbitrated footage as possible. And what I mean by that, for instance, is that I watched like the whole 20-25 minute speech that Diamond Reynolds gave to just basically a crowd of people who were collected to talk to her about her witnessing and, Facebook, putting on Facebook the, horrible murder of her boyfriend in front of her 4-year-old child. And just to watch the whole thing unadulterated and even uncut and processed by any kind of journalist, which at first I did read some of the, reports of what she had said and what she had seen and kind of digesting that from. And I think Washington Post, for instance, did a really excellent job covering a lot of these stories. Yeah. Like they were really on top of it and really nuanced and cracking it open in all kinds of ways. But at any rate, watching her just speak for the 25 minutes, you really just get to see all the kind of like shock and courage that is racing through her system right now. The fact that she was put in this horrible position, but yet she has stepped up to it, which is like, it's like a horrible way to sort of find a leader. But I really felt like, she has a voice and it's important to hear right now.
The point about democratized media and just sort of like media being different, what was strangest to me about the video of Philando Castile dying was that the police didn't say, put down your, like, however illegal and unconstitutional it would have been, we've seen like dozens of police officers try to get on top of the message and try to control the message. And we live at a point in time when a phone being in somebody's hand can communicate things like this happening to, billions of people is exciting and crazy and so democratizing. And, it does take the bravery of someone like that to say she's going to disseminate that message regardless of what the blowback is.
I mean, many people wrote about the kind of amazing and scary clarity that she had in the moment while it's all happening.
Yeah.
I mean, she's sitting there knowing that even though her boyfriend is basically bleeding out, she has to stay calm and keep her hands on her lap where they can see them. And like that's just such an insane moment to witness happening. Like, it's the kind of thing. And I mean, of course, when I was watching that original video, the moment where the tears really came, because I think I was sort of like having the shock with her. But the moment where I started crying is when her 4-year-old daughter comforts her. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the moment where it just felt like, oh, my God, how does this little girl know to say that? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there's just wisdom beyond her years in that moment. And yeah.
Winner.
I mean, I don't know what to say, guys. This has been one of those weeks where I've never had more isolated conversations off social media. Just like I've put my thoughts out there on my page, unfiltered, because I just don't give a shit what anybody thinks. I've always been sort of reserved in my militancy because I know it makes people uncomfortable to know that, one, someone respects and loves their culture so much that they refuse to have it shit on by anybody else, and two, that they would be so willing and free to say it without any, no matter what the consequence is. But there came a point where all I wanted to do, and this is respect to everybody in this room that I love, all I wanted to do was talk to African-American people. Mm. Because the rage that is coursing through my veins is inexplicable. I can't tell you how angry I am still. The amount of time I've spent avoiding actually watching these videos is interesting because I've had to sort of like, it's like playing Mario Kart. I've had to be like, I don't want, don't try it. I know that link where that link is going. I don't want to see it because I don't need to see it to know that it exists. Mm-hmm. I did something that I normally don't do. And that's instead of watching wall to wall coverage, there was a certain point where I couldn't watch anymore. I started watching Melrose Place. I had to watch something that was so removed from this era. Mm. Because this era is disappointing the shit out of me.
Well, there's that time when you're so emotionally keyed up that you can't have anything that just sort of like even references
triggers.
Or
it's
engaged.
All triggers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just need that thing that is like out of it.
Yeah. You had like a grilled cheese, like the equivalent of a grilled cheese in TV land.
Basically. I mean, like even like the fact that they weren't using cell phones and everybody was on like had to pull their antennas out to communicate bullshit was like comforting to me. They had to be calculated because they need to be around a phone to communicate the bullshit on Melrose Place.
Can I ask you something, Winter?
Yes.
Did you have an opinion as far as the when people were sharing these videos? Mm-hmm. Did you feel like that was assaultive in and of itself to be sharing these videos of black people's bodies basically?
No, because I think people need to see it. It sucks that this is what they get to that what they're going to have to see. Do I wish we lived in a world where 50 million views would be to kids, black kids graduating from high school or black kids singing to the postman, hey, Mr. Postman, outside of their house, which
so
is
great.
So adorable.
Yeah.
Would I prefer that that trends and that goes viral and those names? Yes, that would be my preference. Also, would it be my preference that it was like a clean cut businessman with an MBA on his way to his high profile cush job in a high rise instead of people that are typically on the lower economic scale that are getting pulled over and shot at? Would that be my preference? I don't want anybody to get shot. You know what I mean? I would prefer that no one has to have a broken taillight or not, be trying to protect their children and just sell CDs in front of a convenience store. I would prefer that none of these people were murdered.
One of the aspects of this democratized media is that it is unfiltered by journalism. Like, journalism is so good at showing us black men in the way that journalism shows us black men.
Right.
And it's so silly. But the fact that Philando Castile was a cafeteria manager and my mom was a cafeteria manager, made her see the story in a different way. It should not take that. But it did take that.
Yeah.
And, like,
this man has been ripped from these kids' lives.
Yeah.
This is, like, your favorite person during the day.
Yeah.
This is often the person that you can't wait to see. Because not only does he have his fucking tater tots, he's the one who's the purveyor of said tater tots.
It is very interesting the way that these sort of like cycles of dissemination of information, but us consuming information differently now, like are kind of pushing the conversation forward. It is very easy to say that Alton Sterling, he wasn't allowed to have that gun. He is a felon. But then now you can dig deeper and find out he's a felon because of, different application of the law to blacks and whites when it comes to when he was in his early 20s, he had sex with a teenager, like happens all the time in white communities where it isn't criminalized. And the fact that we can now explore further and start to see these patterns, because for most white people, they're patterns that don't come up that much. And they're patterns that only that are filtered through professional media where you're seeing them in this way that like tells you a nice narrative of why this black person was bad. And it is like at least now we can learn more and differently.
The one thing that I was tired of seeing, and this sounds sad because you want one thing that I think people complain about is black people want justice. They want it their way. And yeah, I guess we do. But the one thing, and Oliver saw me on this, I don't want to see any more fucking Martin Luther King quotes. Okay. I'm like so over that because this is what white people do. And when I say white people, you know who I'm talking about. But what they do is they take the quote that means the most to them that they read about in school, then they post it. Then they say their little thing, and then they flitter on to the next tasty video. And here's the thing. It's like, you've basically, by posting that to me, and I retweeted an article on my Twitter page about it, you're just kind of scratching, you're not even scratching the surface of black history. you're talking about something that's pretty freaking typical. It's like literally the perimeter of the supermarket. It's something that you, it's easily to easy to grab, and it serves its purpose, and then you can move on. People have to do a little
Everyone
bit more.
Everyone should be great. Like, that's not
exactly.
an answer.
Right. That's not an answer. It's not.
What happened in Dallas.
No disrespect to Martin Luther King, okay?
Right. it was a different time. What happened in Dallas made me feel very, very guilty that we've all been politely talking about incremental change, and that's somebody snapped because nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. And I'm, of course, not saying that that is justified, mm-hmm. but it is understandable, mm-hmm. especially like the weird intersection of Second Amendment rights and the murder of black people over the past week is fascinating. And you can say whatever you like about no one should have guns, but what we have now is a situation where something is a constitutional right for one race and a reason to be executed for another race.
100%.
And as a lawyer, that makes me real, real, real uncomfortable, especially just a couple of weeks after the 4th of July. And one of the really great things for me was a podcast called The Black Guy Who Tips. It's a married couple in North Carolina named Rod and Karen. I couldn't figure out their last names. But they had two comics who I know, Ray Sani and Alex English, on. And it was just, as a white person, consuming four African Americans processing this was good for me. Like, it was when you're at that point where you're like, I know I need to listen. Where should I listen? And it's not like I don't have black, you know, friends and colleagues and all of that, but it was good to listen to a conversation where there was not a white person putting their oar in. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, my favorite moment possibly from all of this was, I believe, on Meet the Press. Like, I was watching my Sunday morning shows, or I was listening to the podcast, and it was a white police chief and a black law enforcement official. And the host said to the black law enforcement official, have you had... You yourself, a lifelong law enforcement official, he's high ranking in some way, have you had the talk with your son? And he said, yes, and I'll leave it at that. And this person who, because his position is so embattled as a black man and a law enforcement official, can't talk in depth because he can't make other law enforcement feel like he is not having their back and all of that. And then white guy police chief was like, well, let me comment on this, because I had a talk with my son about how you should always be deferential and responsible when you're around a law enforcement official. And it was just one of those, shut the f-. Like, it was just such a glaring, it was like one of the best, like, incidents of mansplaining I've ever seen. And it was just this dude who, like, was so not getting it. And it, like... made me mad. And then luckily it was Meet the Press, where you then go to the panel,
right.
And one of the dudes on the panel was like, fuck that dude, but not in those terms. And you did feel like there was a response, but it is just, you know, we're at one of those times where there is a new and different tone deafness. We made all those civil rights movies about the other kind of tone deafness, and we calibrated all of our civil rights like sensibilities to that, and now we don't understand the new and different way that finding equivalencies between what like a white police chief's son experiences dealing with law enforcement and a black kid is blah.
You know who was an unfortunate casualty of all of this, just to lighten it up for a moment? Brian Williams. Because Brian Williams, I've pretty much only watched CNN religiously because I just have a thing for Wolf Blitzer and Frederica Whitfield and, to a lesser extent, Don Lemon. Yeah, I like them.
Okay.
Brian Williams will take any and every opportunity. I don't think this man slept this entire time to have his moment. And he, for MSNBC, their coverage was a little bit more, a little bit better for in terms of Dallas. You know, they talked to a wide breadth of people and talked to, you know, they had the police chief on, and he's just so cool, calm, and collected, and really trying to express why he did what he did with the robot. Uh-huh. I call it T-1000 meets Rumba. He was basically saying, look, like we had no choice but to take the power out of this guy's hands. But Brian Williams still bringing up Barack, still bringing up being in the war zone.
Oh, God.
And I was like, boo, don't bring this up no more.
Yeah, you've already been caught.
You've already been caught. We know that bullet didn't hit. And somebody tweeted, oh, Brian Williams just said
next
a bullet.
He's going to say that he, like, rumbled with one of those robots.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can't Brian Williams go be on Match Game? Like, yes. Does he have Match Game again?
Yes.
Or maybe there's, like, a sub-network to MSNBC that he can get demoted to.
Yeah. Poor boo.
All right, you guys. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about lighter, brighter things in the world of fantasy after this.
Hey guys, this is Adam Conover. You may know me from my True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. Well, guess what? Now we're doing a podcast version right here on Maximum Fun. What we do is we take all the interesting, fascinating experts that we talk to for just a couple minutes on the show, and we sit with them for an entire podcast, really going deep and getting into the fascinating details of their work. Find Adam Ruins Everything wherever you get your podcasts or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Sky Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
And we thought we would remove ourselves from all things actually existing in our world for a moment and talk about the world of fantasy. Oliver, what does fantasy mean to you?
What immediately comes to mind are the sort of classic magazine covers from heavy metal magazine of the 1980s. I think most of which were usually involved some leather-clad women with ample cleavage riding some kind of fantastic animal, whether it's a pterodactyl or one of them was like a chrome dolphin or a chrome tiger or something like that.
That's how I got to
shark.
Pop Rocket today.
Yes. That is how she
fabulous.
Rolls. Yeah.
As a deep fantasy nerd, that was a crossover I never entirely understood, that whole heavy metal songs about the Hobbit and, you know.
Well, heavy metal, but Heavy Metal Magazine was a fantasy magazine that just happened to have the name Heavy Metal. So I don't think it was really about the music genre. It was like sort of Dragon Magazine, but for like the 18 plus crowd.
But there is a relationship between
oh, sure,
metal
of course.
And fantasy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you
sure.
saw the same kind of iconography in both.
Yeah. There was, what was the name, Christian, of the video game that came out just a couple of years ago?
Brutal Legend.
Brutal Legend. And Brutal Legend was like very much sort of like hitting that point of like barbarian and girl with titties out and a lot of writing on like dragons and stuff.
Right.
That was not the fantasy I wanted to participate in. I wanted songs and Elvish.
Real quick. I think what those covers and really just the world of fantasy in the 1980s when I was growing up as a kid, I think on a very subconscious level, though it was very explicit in the artwork itself, it just made me assume that fantasy was a genre that was either created by or for men, even though there's obviously evidence contrary to that, but it sort of created that sense of it, you know?
I would say it is kind of the most white, male, 15-year-old boy, libertarian of genres as one who participated hard. But I feel like it speaks very much to, like, it's boys who like to be on their own because they're not good at hanging out with other boys. Mm. Margaret, what was, as a 15-year-old boy, what was your consumption of of fantasy?
Well, I did distinctly have that feeling that fantasy was not for me. Mm. And I still have that feeling. I really don't. I mean, I would say of all genres that are genre-y, that is the one that I feel like I have a giant blind spot around.
But you are the hardcore Game of Thrones watcher amongst
I
us.
Know, but that is like the one exception.
Okay.
That is the one exception. And I think true Game of Thrones people are like, oh, she's the kind of person that got into it when it got normalized by HBO, which is 100% true. Mm.
But girls, fantasy, magic, fairies.
Yes.
I would go so far as to say the world of Strawberry Shortcake.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if that so much as, I mean, My Little Pony solidly, Rainbow Bright, definitely.
Yes.
And like, as somebody who, did I mention on this show that I managed to swindle my parents into buying me all of the She-Ra stuff by saying it was part of the He-Man universe?
Oh, nice. Well, yes. It was.
It
you
was.
Were speaking my language.
But like, yeah, magic is a woman thing.
Yeah.
So why is this world of fantasy as we construe it not a woman thing?
Well, because I think when we talk about fantasy, usually the images that come up are like the ones that Oliver just described of like women in armor, you know, riding on some kind of big fluffy dragon or whatever. And I don't, you know, you just said Rainbow Bright and My Little Pony and Strawberry Shortcake. And you're right. I played with all of those. And there was a sort of fantasy world engaged around those. I would say like my fantasy world was, yeah, around animals and fairies and make-believe and things like that. But yeah, I forgot your question.
I think children's fantasy is a little bit more open to all genders. I think adult fantasy suddenly gets funneled into sort of maledom. Not masculinity, but maledom, if you will.
I mean, we do have a notion that women aren't supposed to create their own worlds and that women are supposed to be preoccupied with real-life domesticity.
Yes, domesticity and reality are women's purview. Mm. And guys get to dream big. Guys get to create worlds.
Well, the thing is like, if a woman's being fucked over in this world, she gets to fantasize about a better approach to this world. If a dude's getting fucked over in this world, there's something wrong with that dude, and he has to go to a whole new world to try to figure out who and what and how he's going to succeed.
You just blew my mind with that one. Winner,
what about you?
I have such a long list. When I think of my childhood in terms of fantasy, I really immediately go to horror movies, but I know that's what we're not talking about. So the first thing that came to mind, you touched on a bunch of them.
I would say Leprechaun borders on being appropriate.
Leprechaun? The troll Leprechaun?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yay! Yeah, okay.
Sorry for interrupting.
Okay, that's okay. Lisa Frank. Her entire universe, to me, screams, like, fantasy because it was all about the thing that I loved about Lisa Frank School Supplies is that it allowed you to look at it in its beauty, and it definitely took me away in between class when I would pull out this amazing Trapper Keeper with this unicorn floating on a cirrus cloud into a land of rainbows and hearts and drawn so beautifully.
I never thought about it before, but Lisa Frank binders are entirely populated by the animals that big-titted women ride in low fantasy.
Yes, this is giving them their own world.
Unicorns are definitely, those belong to women.
Yes.
I mean, come on, men have no business riding a unicorn ever.
No. But the one thing that I grew up, that I was really tied to in terms of fantasy, is Pippi Longstocking, because Pippi was empowered by her father to take care of things and to run the house as she saw fit. And, you know, she had the talking monkey, the monkey that did what, I don't think the monkey talked, actually. The monkey just did whatever she wanted it to do and was kind of like her buddy. I think the horse spoke, right? So she was, like, able to sort of create this world that worked for her. And I think that's any rambunctious little girl's fantasy, is to have a world that is dictated by your whims and your and bows to your means.
I have never seen any Pippi Longstocking films, but would you like me to sing the theme song to the mid-'80s Pippi Longstocking?
Yes.
Pippi Longstocking is coming into your world. Oh, I thought it was Town.
I don't know. I never saw the movie.
Okay.
Good job,
okay.
Guys.
Wow. I have more.
Wow.
The Wizard of Oz I saw at 5 because it was my mom's favorite movie.
Right.
And I remember they colorized it and it was like a big freaking deal. It was like the biggest deal ever.
The Wizard of Oz as touchstone of fantasy.
Yeah.
I've never entirely understood, which is weird because I'm a gay guy and I'm like really deeply supposed to.
There's straight up witches
like,
in there.
Yeah.
God knows, I loved
flying
it.
Monkeys.
I loved it as a child, but I've never really understood why it was as much a narrative of liberation that it was to gay guys in the way that like, with The Little Mermaid, I get that. Like, I
Maybe
get why Frozen
drugged.
Is for us.
Maybe she was drugged the entire time, and the fact that she put a performance like the way she did, given that she was drugged the entire time. But that's a totally different episode of Pop Rocket. I'm thinking also of Big. Big to me. Big.
Oh, yeah. The fantasy of being a kid again.
Yeah. Those were like my, obviously it makes sense that those are like would be my favorite. I wanted to be an adult so quickly. But just the idea that you can live out your dreams in this fantasy world and then ultimately kind of come back to Earth. I think Big is one of the quintessential. When that movie came out, I just really, really, I just think that every kid identified.
The Freaky Friday,
yeah,
vice
oh,
versa.
Freaky Friday,
why would I
all
want,
of that.
Why would I want to be grown up when I could be a sorceress? like Thundar the Barbarian, super loved it, deeply identified with what's her name, the sorceress. Like it was always, I can't, like, I don't understand people who go into like a role playing game and are like, I want to be a warrior. Fuck you. There are swords in real life. I want to throw a fireball. So I did spend last Sunday with nerds in a generic role-playing system that we have built our own fantasy world for.
Mm.
So, what?
Yes. It's real deep nerdy. So that, I read a lot of fantasy novels as a young man. I was deeply into...
Which ones?
Oh, I mean... A lot of Piers Anthony.
Okay.
A lot of... see, the thing is I started out on the ones that other boys at school had, like your Piers Anthony. But not that there were many readers at Tierra Buena Elementary School. Believe you me, it was not a quality that was looked for in a boy. But then I sort of got on a vein of these female authors. And to me, I didn't really think about the fact that they were female authors. I just liked the books, and then I kept going. But, like, there was this woman named Jennifer Robertson who had this land of weird Native American people who could turn into animals, but they were, like, alongside sort of, like, traditional European-style fantasy. Wonderful. There's this woman named Mercedes Lackey, I've talked about before, who had gay characters come up, like, overly accessorized, unbuttoned down to their navel, like, gay mages with magical horses that they had telepathic powers with. And it was so overwhelming to me that I had to hide the book and considered telling on myself to my mom that I had read a gay book.
Start snapping that rubber band on your wrist.
Yeah.
I was the world's coolest 14-year-old. So, like, what would you say... are your primary consumptions of like old school high or low fantasy, like of this, like, you know, a created world? Let's say created world that's not sci-fi.
Choose your own adventure books.
Okay,
I love that choice because I wouldn't have thought of it intuitively, but sure, yeah, why not?
I mean, just the fantasy of even having a choice in a story like that. I mean, I think the fact, too, that most of those books were rooted around some sort of fantastical setting. And,
yes.
Like, you'd have a door, and it was like, do you want to open the door or just run away from the door? Like, do you take the key? Do you bury the key? What do you do? And there's something about that choose-your-own-adventure choice where, like, that – I mean, that's still, I think, for people of my generation who are writers, that, like, breaks open your whole concept of what a book can do.
Yeah.
Did it train you for regret? Because those books, I was so much FOMO flowing over a young Guy Branum reading a Choose Your Own Adventure novel.
Well, it sounds like you were a much more obedient child than I was because I cheated all the time. I would, like, make a choice and I'd be like, oh, no, I don't like that thread. And I would go back and, like, choose the other one.
I was resolute about reading all possible endings for the book. And Choose Your Own Adventure books were the great way that, like, children 3rd, 4th, 5th grade got around reading a 200-page book.
Yeah.
They weren't that long.
Right, it becomes like
saying
130 tops.
Yes, but they're also like 60 once you actually get to the end of a story.
I'm just curious, who here has read My Name is Jonah, which I feel like was one of the first early Choose Your Own Adventure books?
Not familiar with
it. I know the Weezer song.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, never mind. That was the first one I read, and the thing that I think, it was the first book in which, like, you could die, like, characters died. Clearly, I hadn't read much else, but I was like, whoa, like, I'm dead, like, 3 times out of 4 if I choose the wrong ending, like, I end up dead somehow, which was sort of, the idea of mortality in a narrative was sort of new to me, at least within, like, books, basically.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about stakes and fantasy. Like, Oliver, when you were putting together ideas about this, you sort of brought up the idea that fantasy implies something that is divorced from reality. Do you think that that's necessarily true, or has there been fantasy with sort of, like, relevance or sort of allegory that, like, really spoke to you?
Well, I think the fantasy I liked as a lot as a kid tended to be one – I think people would consider it much more light in terms of very entertaining. Like, I really got into a lot of David Eddings' book. And I've talked about this.
We've talked about this.
A long time ago. But he's like very, very, like, third generation Tolkien derivative, super light. I thought cleverly written.
They're so fine. They're a little bit funny, and they're, like,
yes,
so adequate.
Yes.
What a story.
Yes.
Like, it is compelling, and you get all the way through.
Right.
And it's like a well-made TV show, but it's never kind of about anything.
Right, exactly. And that was that's sort of what I gravitated to, but I'm sure there
except
are...
Except maybe from modeling heterosexual relationships for us.
You thought it was... Wait, what about that aspect?
Oh, just sort of like, I would say that, what's his name, the main kid and his... Sinedra. Right. And Sinedra...
I love that you remember this.
That was a relationship that I learned a lot from. Fucking Silk and Liesel, his lady. I mean, that was a romance that meant a lot to me. Like, they were...
Deeply heteronormative, though.
I know, but also a little bit His Girl Friday in a way that I really enjoyed.
But I was going to say, I mean... Absolutely, there is so much fantasy out there that is allegorical. It is basically just thinly veiled versions of everyday politics and race relations and whatever else. Mm. So, I mean, that's a huge strain of fantasy, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of it's allegorical. You know what I mean? It just changes the landscape and the characters and possibly the species of the characters. Yeah. But it's essentially always a human story. I mean, we can't get away from that. We can't get away from constructing stories that are interesting to us.
That I'm glad you brought that up because it reminds me of Candyman. The narrative was that Candyman was a slave who'd been hung and because he was engaged in a relationship with a white woman. And then he came back in Cabrini Green Projects. And if you said his name 5 times, he would appear and then he would gut you. And that movie it still haunts me to this day. It's been over like 20 years since it came out, but it haunts me because it wasn't just a typical, like it mirrored the reality of what was happening, the violence in Chicago, what was going on in these projects. It also talked about something historical having to do with slavery, and obviously interracial relationships were like illegal at this point. But then it also talked about just the fantastical notion that this man would come back and the woman that he had set his sights on in present day was an embodiment of the woman he was in love with. There was so much fantasy involved with it that it didn't feel like a typical horror movie, why I think it has such a cult following.
I mean, this sounds to me, as someone we're talking about this off air, you have not seen any of the Harry Potter films and obviously read the books. You don't watch Game of Thrones.
Nope.
But it seems for you, your entry into fantasy is really the fantasy horror kind of split, right?
Or so not like split, Clive Barker and, you know, Lovecraft and anything that sort of, because I like the idea that things, fantasy, not Game of Thrones is pretty brutal, but like there's like I liked Legend growing up, but I saw Legend because Tom Cruise was in it.
Legend's,
you know what I
so
mean?
Good.
Legend is so good.
Oh, I'm sorry. Legend or Labyrinth?
Legend is Tom Cruise. Labyrinth is David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly. Yeah, Legend is Mia Sara and Tom Cruise.
Legend or Labyrinth?
Legend is Tom Cruise.
No, okay. I'm saying
you
which
fools. One? Oh, which one?
Yes.
Labyrinth. Labyrinth is the correct answer.
Legend, it was always Legend for me.
I've never seen either.
Oh, fuck you.
Labyrinth for Brian Froud alone. I was just going to bring him up. His illustrations of fairies.
Okay. Yeah.
Labyrinth is so amazing and like gets a young, not Phoebe Cates, Jennifer Connelly at like right the point, the exactly the right point in time.
Yeah.
But I honestly liked Legend a little better.
It was a little
bit more sexual and a little bit fucked up in a way that I found really compelling.
Okay, maybe I should rewatch it then.
Okay. So one issue here is that we traditionally have not had space for black people or really anyone who was not white and European in fantasy. Like in Tolkien, you have the Haradrim marching up, which is at most giving you kind of Arabs, I guess.
And Jar Jar Binks.
But I would say one. And that's why it was like realizing what Lando Calrissian meant to black Americans.
Another black dude.
Yeah, is kind of like. It was hard for me to wrap my head around. Anyway, a book. Okay, there is one sort of black female sci-fi author of note, but she wrote one novel that was kind of more fantasy than sci-fi called Kindred. And it is...
Should you mention the author?
Oh, Octavia Butler. Okay. Yeah. And
didn't she write The Matrix?
I don't know.
Okay, that's not her.
Okay, Kindred is about a woman living in Los Angeles, black woman married to a white guy, who just gets transported through time repeatedly to Maryland, where she has to save one of her ancestors, one of her white ancestors, from being killed so that she can be born eventually.
Mm.
And it's basically making this woman go back in time and be a slave. And in one instance, her husband gets pulled back with her. And the weird way that, like, living that existence changes her and living in a world with slavery changes her husband and their relationship. It's an awesome book. And there are a lot of sort of, like, imagined you travel back through time and are a slave YA books now. But, like, Kindred is just amazing. That they have not made this into a movie yet is testament to how little power black women have in Hollywood.
Yeah, I feel like Octavia Butler's really having a moment, and hopefully there will be a movie of that soon. But I don't know if you guys have caught this furor that's been going on.
Underground Airlines,
which is a book that just came out written by a guy named Ben H. Winters. And I actually know Ben from a long time ago in Chicago, so I'm a little biased talking about his book because I think he's really smart and thoughtful. But he caught a certain degree of flack because there was this profile of him in the New York Times because Underground Airlines is basically a dystopian look at America if the Civil War had never happened, that if Lincoln was shot and slavery was still legal in certain states. So he has it that about four states in the United States are still allowing slavery, and that the main character of this book is a bounty hunter, basically. He goes and catches slaves who have run away, and he's a black man himself. And Ben Winters is a white man. And so a lot of people were like, what business is it of yours to write this story? Again, because I know Ben, I know he's smart, and I know he researched the fuck out of this because he's that kind of smart guy. But he has paid a lot of homage to Kindred as a major inspiration point.
And the wonderful thing about Octavia Butler is that everything else, like most of the other stuff she wrote, doesn't deal with race in or our world. Like, it's
Sower of the Seed. I mean, that's a whole, like, go ahead.
It's like it is not dealing with race politics as they exist for us. Like, it is a,
well, it's, I mean, again, in the sense that it's always an allegory, there's always some other framing
yes,
of it,
right?
Yeah, it is.
Can I
a broader story? I may be incorrect. I haven't read that much else of hers. I was just
Slavery runs through, I feel like, her catalog.
Slavery does run through a lot of her work.
I wanted to say something because I'm wondering if the reason why this narrative doesn't work with black characters is because black people as we know it wouldn't subscribe to this shit. Like, I feel like a black person, if they saw a fairy, they'd be like, the fuck is that? Like,
there are a lot of really underserved black nerds out there. Like, there are a lot of deeply, deeply underserved black nerds out there who love this stuff and are hungry for a place in
I'm talking about just how do you script that character to be authentic to the way our culture is perceived and how we exist. How do you frame that? It's so fantastical. It's like, so, you know, you don't ever see like look how they put Leslie Jones in Ghostbusters. Look how they put Winston, how he kind of didn't believe this shit but was going with it for the paycheck. You know, like, there's almost like, you don't see black people chasing ghosts on TV shows.
Although
you,
I was going to say, there's also the sort of like magical Negro who does see the ghosts. And he does like get to tap into this other world.
Right. Like in The Shining.
But I think like African-American teens who deeply, deeply love Japanese RPGs are like an important group. Like, there are totally, like, as somebody who worked in video games for a while, there are totally the African-American gamers who are participating in sort of, like, culturally understood, like, sports games and that kind of thing that we understand that's what a black teen plays. But then there are these nerds who are, I think, a little bit hungry for a world where their race isn't the most present thing about them and isn't the most significant part of the conversation.
Right. Well, to go back to Ben Winters for a second, because I think what I want to say about that story is that the New York Times profile called him brave for tackling this issue.
Fearless.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people were like, what are you talking about? Why is it brave for him to do it? And then somebody like Octavia Butler, who was a true, like, pioneer in this realm, like, kind of has almost gotten buried by literary history and only recently resuscitated in a sense. So I think that's also interesting too. I feel like there probably is this like secret timeline of like, fantasy work that's been created by people of color that just gets buried.
Well, and also, I mean, at a time when it took a whole lot more to get published, probably just didn't get seen that much. Mm-hmm. But I would like to talk about the less obvious ways that fantasy is hooked into, like, the real world. Like, for me, it was so eye-opening to realize that Tolkien, this guy who sort of, like, built, like, wizard-based sword fantasy of the 20th century as we know it, like, understanding the ways that being, like, in the trenches in World War One, like, all of these kids with these excellent Cambridge and Oxford educations being dumped into a trench and then having, like, the world explode with machines that they had never seen before kind of fucked their brains, and the way that, for him, The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings were processing that. And for me, the turning point was realizing that General Petain at Verdun, I think, said, "They shall not pass," in French, of course. And realizing that, you know, like, Tolkien and sort of him pitting this, like, nice bucolic world of no machinery versus evil that is all machinery and unnatural was him trying to figure out what war is now. And I really, honestly, deeply believe that fantasy is a gateway drug for historical nonfiction.
Yeah.
Like, I really feel like I would not have developed the passion and taste that I have for long books about Prussia if it weren't for, like, Tolkien just putting a little bit of a shine and some magic and some named swords in there that would make me, like, get into going deep, deep, deep into the hole of how all of this works.
Yeah, I mean, you can get interested in a bayonet battle if there's elves fighting it.
Exactly! And it's training wheels for paying attention to dry history.
Yeah.
They kind of did that in middle school for us in history by showing us Excalibur. Because Excalibur...
Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah. I think my grade school did the same thing.
Yeah, and I mean, Excalibur is by no means, like, you know, an easy watch. It's kind of a little... There's definitely boobies in it. But it was interesting that that's how we started the discussion about... God, what am I thinking about? Talking about, you know, Henry VIII
And like a million different England versus France
wars. And the Magna Carta. And yeah. All and other, you know, like.
Apparently Game of Thrones is really just early War of the Roses. It started out with him sort of like thinking about the War of the Roses and then just sort of like extrapolating out and putting some dragons over it.
Well, right. If you look at the map of Game of Thrones, and I always thought the map is like the first indicator that you're in fantasy world.
Yes.
If you open a book and you see a map of that you don't recognize the place.
So satisfying to a young guy,
so
Branham.
Satisfying. But the map, I mean, it looks like a sort of bastardized version of Europe.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, just Great Britain. I mean, the Westeros?
Yeah. I mean, kind of, I mean, both. You could really see both.
Nicely physically separated from the East and those other colored peoples. None of you have ever paid attention to the Shannara Chronicles on MTV, but it is my obligation to. MTV attempted to do their own off-brand Game of Thrones with...
This is the second time you shit on it.
It's so terrible. But Glenn Weldon calling it the Methadone of fantasy novels is just a thing I will go to in my heart. It was just that, like, fantasy novel. I mean, the trouble with fantasy is you're in such a removed world that you do need to give us a lot of explanation of how long it takes to get somewhere. You need to describe in depth how they killed those rabbits and ate those rabbits so that you feel like you're in it. And the Shannara Chronicles, you just get places too quickly and they never describe meals. Mm. And what's the fun in that?
Exactly.
Well, sorry.
I mean, we've had this big moment for a while now for fantasy. Lord of the Rings movies started coming out like 15 years ago. Game of Thrones is still going strong. Will this be over? Will this beautiful moment in pop culture history diminish and go into the West?
Winter shaking her head.
No, because I was going to bring up how HBO is doing Westworld, which is a remake of the movie from the 70s with Yul Brynner. Mm.
But it's sci-fi.
It's sci-fi, but it's totally in my...
I mean, is it kind of a bleed?
But sci-fi fantasy are...
They bleed together.
Yeah, they're very blurry.
I don't want them to bleed together. Okay.
You don't want them to bleed together.
I mean, we didn't really talk about the distinction between the two.
Let's talk about
that. And I think the distinction is, like, magic on the fantasy side and technology on the sci-fi side.
And those two working together, anytime you have magic and, like, overdeveloped technology, I need a really good explanation for that. Star Wars, I'm fine with.
But Star Wars is a bleed by that definition.
Absolutely,
you know?
But I'm saying it is a well-constructed bleed.
Yeah.
Where, say, Piers Anthony's Apprentice Adept series, I'm a little bit like, no, this is too much.
Can I finish my thought?
Yes.
I was going to say that Westworld, the reason why I'm excited for that and why I think it's going to carry on is because, you know, one of the things I hate more than ever is when people don't get to actually think out their universe because the world won't let them be great. I think of, like, Army of Darkness and how it's taken so long to get to more of the Evil Dead series with Ash versus the Evil Dead. But Westworld sort of goes, especially because it's looking at the future of how we're going to be serviced, how we're going to... You have a Disneyland, but you're going to need more than a Disneyland. You're going to need robots to service you. You're going to need them. Those are all fantasy things that we're always thinking about, like how much more, because we're becoming so desensitized. Look, we've got the ability to watch death live on Facebook now. That took only less than 8 years. So now we can get to the point where we have to think of a universe that's larger than what we've been given, which is why, you know, Game of Thrones, you can do that for 10, 12, 15 years, but there's going to have to be something else that supplants that.
I think in the same way that the comic book movie and superhero movies seem to be with us for a while really has less to do with whether or not there's good narratives, there may or may not be. I think a lot of it has to do with, is because FX technology makes those things possible.
Exactly.
So you have, you know, the past, you know, century worth of fantasy series and books to plumb for it. Yeah. I mean, I am excited to see The Dark Tower get made because I think that's one of Stephen King's really kind of best, you know, straight up series. And it's a very rich world. And it absolutely could be
that's
shit.
What I'm
His track
about
record
is just
not
great.
if he just stands away from it and lets somebody else take the wheel.
For work, we ended up watching Snow White and the Huntsman, Winter's War, was such a magnificent cum dump of like.
Is that a bad thing?
It's a fair response.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It was just like it was seeing what we do when we have lots of FX technology to throw at something and no good ideas.
Right.
And it's troublesome that it's easier to do that now.
What do you want to see made?
Oh, that's a great question. Somebody else answer first.
We talked about this last week kind of as a joke with Kanye, but I think Dune absolutely could get remade because that one film, it was fine. But the Dune world, even though the book series by the end gets really, really nuts, the first two or three, really solid, fascinating world, giant worms. I mean, what more could you possibly want?
That's a great answer. Also, I love that the Golden Compass got made. I don't want them to go... I was a little bit happy that they didn't get to go further in the book series. But those books are so fucking good, and it is such a magnificently realized world. It was really, really nice.
I would say an Ursula K. Le Guin book, which I feel like she's barely gotten – I mean, has she gotten anything?
No. There is the weird way that those ladies from the 70s who did produce so much good stuff
– and McCaffrey.
I'll say a Pern – like a fucking Pern movie. That would be really exciting. That's one of those situations that's sci-fi that looks like fantasy, and I love it.
Yes, The Left Hand of Darkness is the one that I would vote for.
Okay.
Well, I had a quick Pern-like sidebar thing, but
okay.
I forget the name of the book, but what I loved about The Dragons of Pern, or Dragon Riders of Pern, is that it starts off as fantasy, and then like 8 books in, she reveals the backstory, and it becomes sci-fi.
You learn how Kitty Ping genetically engineered them after the Atlantis
astronauts came. Yes, exactly.
We interrupt.
I love that we know this. Anyways.
I was just going to say Alien Nation. Because Alien Nation,
Alien Nation?
Alien Nation was a movie in the late 80s, and then it became Mandy Patinkin.
Margaret,
Alien.
You need to see this movie.
You need to see this movie.
It also spawned a pretty good Fox series.
Yes, exactly.
But it was like sci-fi's attempt to deal with race in Los Angeles, and kind of, not black and white race, a little bit more, way more, Asian white race.
Yeah. Wow.
So they're like... These aliens, I forget what they're called, but they were like overachieving recent immigrants, and the first one makes detective, and it's like Jimmy Kahn as a, you know, sort of like hard-boiled police detective, and then Mandy Patinkin as his sort of like...
docile, like really by-the-book smart...
A little bit Jewish, a little bit Chinese kind of alien partner, and they could be melted by seawater.
It's interesting.
It was it was like V, like when V came out, and V also was basically like the Holocaust all over again. Because who doesn't want to revisit that? But Alien Nation, they already tried to redo V, and V haunted me for years because they were lizards posing in human form.
It was a great series.
It was a great series. But yeah. Alien Nation, I loved the take of Alien Nation. I really, really loved that. I would see them try to do that
and
again.
And just that it was a buddy cop.
I want
cop.
Jimmy Fox to do
I
it.
Love a good buddy cop movie.
Me too.
Okay. All right. I mean, you already kind of asked this question, but the question you have in here is any examples of fantasy you think have potential in the future?
Yeah.
I just want to bring in that, like, steampunk has not seen its day. One of the wonderful things about video games is that they really do explore worlds that, like, the film industry hasn't gotten into yet. And I have been excited about the extent to which film has and TV have caught on to things like Game of Thrones. But I would really like to see better steampunk. Also, will anyone here tell me whether the Hellboy movies were good or bad? Because I've seen all of them and can't decide.
I'm going to say no, but I don't know.
I think much... who's the director? Please help me.
Del Toro.
I think his visual imagination is amazing. I don't think he's a particularly great storyteller as a filmmaker. And I think that the Hellboy series... I mean, there's the... Is it the troll market in Hellboy 2 is like one of the best 10 minutes... like practical effects, things you're ever going to see in film. But the film around it is like,
More effects than story is the story of the Hobbit movies. And that's a fair point. I never saw it that way. But off of steampunk, does anyone have any other sort of like forms of fantasy you would like to see explored?
I want to see I saw Swiss Army Man last week with Paul Dano and Daniel Radcliffe, directed by the Daniels. And the Daniels did the Turn Down for What video, which kind of went viral.
That was a great video.
It's a great video.
It's insane.
It's a visually stunning film, and that the film is, spoiler. The film is about suicide, it's about psychosis, and it's about stalking. And it looks, and it's all wrapped in what looks like a buddy film about a guy befriending a corpse. And maybe having like some...
That's pretty great.
It's pretty great, but then you realize what it's really about. And I'm thinking, like, if we're talking about fantasy, the whole movie is like one big fever dream. And then it sort of wraps up towards the end about, oh, this is actually really creepy as fuck. But I just would love to see people take, just like The Lobster, I love people taking risks like that.
Yes.
If you can keep me enraptured for almost nearly 2 hours with something that is completely ridiculous and not realistic, and I walk away from it feeling moved, I mean, I think that's important.
Grand Budapest Hotel. I never thought about it, but like Wes Anderson in his twee is kind of giving you
fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Grand Budapest Hotel, like, it was a stunning moment for me when I realized it was a Holocaust movie.
Yeah.
But the way that it manages to remove us from reality enough that we are able to explore sort of like the death of a world and a culture was charming and perfect.
I think we have to devote more time than we have time for today to talk about it. But the success of Pokemon Go.
Oh, God.
Oh, yes. I meant to bring that up.
But
let's talk about it, because
that's a whole episode into itself.
Yeah,
they have more users now than Twitter.
But
it's been like
that is insane.
Wait, somebody explain to me what the hell it is.
So Margaret,
go in.
You open it up on your phone.
Okay,
and there are Pokemon around you in the world around you. You can go and you can't see them with your eyes, but you turn on your camera phone and you see the Pokemon in front of you. And you can get it. And it is wonderful. And it is honestly what the future of fantasy should be, is opening up the world around us. And, like, it is the...
So it's not some GPS thing where you're like, oh, you have to go over into that room to see the Pokemon.
I mean, yes, you do.
Oh, okay.
So you have to, like, hunt around. It is a great way for parents to get their children to go on walks with them. Yes. But, I mean, the whole premise of Pokemon was always you have to walk around in the high grass because they are waiting there. And you go, and there's, like... a little map, and you see where there are leaves flying up, so you need to go and get them. And it, like, turns your little world into a...
But what is this?
More magical
place. Winter's showing me a screen of where the Pokemon
that
is.
That is my character, Jungle Oatmeal. Uh-huh. And she is going to find the Pokemon as soon as she starts walking around.
Is the building we're in a Pokemon gym? Is that what I see there?
Yeah.
But no. I thought you just said it was some sort of camera phone thing. Like, you're like, you're just there looking. I'm looking at Oliver through my camera phone.
It'll augment. It will augment your camera once you get close to the Pokemon. It'll show you what the camera sees, but then it'll put a Pokemon into the camera.
Yeah.
Margaret's expression now is like delicious. I just want everyone to know this.
It's a gym.
I feel frightened and cold.
But Margaret, it is doing what the makers of Westworld couldn't imagine. Yeah. They imagined you would have to go to some place that would be heightened and full of fantasy.
But it's making your world.
It's making your world heightened and full of fantasy.
We have to come back to this topic in a future episode, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I will play it. I will try.
It is fucking delightful.
So all of you guys are playing it.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. Into it. Jungle Oatmeal. Follow me.
All right, you guys. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back with our jams after this.
The three of you enter a cave of a big red dragon and is standing over a hoard of precious golden rubies. And he says, "What do you do, adventurers? I'm a dragon man."
I cast fire on him. It's very good.
I address the red dragon to say, "Us, we're the hosts of The Adventure Zone, a podcast about family playing Dungeons & Dragons."
Very good synergy. Commit to the bit.
I roll to charm new listeners. It is very effective, against all odds.
Everybody, we're the McRoys. We host The Adventure Zone, a podcast where we play Dungeons & Dragons together. It's a comedy podcast. We don't take the rules too seriously because there's a lot of them and we did not take the time to learn them. Maybe listen to us. We come out every other Thursday on the Maximum Fun Network. You can find us on iTunes or on MaximumFun.org. I think this promo is a critical hit.
Having a properly appreciated the moment, as Winter Mitchell demanded, I now welcome you back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Sky Branham. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
Winter Mitchell.
Why did you go last, Winter? Oh.
I just felt like it.
It's understandable. Winter, you know that every week on Pop Rocket, we ask a question.
You do.
Can you remind me of what that question is?
Something about a jam.
It's something about a jam. Winter Mitchell, do you have a jam currently?
I do. I want everybody to just feel good. I posted the song for the weekend on the Pop Rocket Facebook group, Love's in Need of Love Today. So I wanted to post, it's Monday today as we're taping, something that was powerful and reinforcing and, you know, don't judge the messenger. This is pre all the bullshit. It's Champions by Kanye. Back to school with a new wardrobe and think he did when he packed it up and brought it back to the crib. Just a little something, show you how we live. Everything I wanted, man, it seems so serious. That's that shit. So if you gonna do it, do it just
this
like
is the Kanye I miss.
This is the Kanye I miss too, man.
Chop up the soul, Kanye.
Margaret, you got a jam?
I do. I have a jam from a modern day witch known as Bat for Lashes. This song is called In God's House. Picture Stevie Nicks if Kate Bush were to ghost into her body.
So that's looking like a little Karen O-ish.
Yeah, totally. So that's from her new album called The Bride.
What should I know about her?
Remember a few years ago, she had that video that got really viral. It's like her and a couple other people on bikes, and they're in rabbit costumes, and they would go like this above the bikes. If I showed it to you, you'd be like, oh yeah.
All right.
2010.
I will check it out. All right, this week I am going to offer into debate and discussion. It's summer jam season. We are looking, and we have not discussed the song that presented itself as summer jam. So let us listen to it and then discuss whether Mr. Timberlake has claim to the cause of summer jam.
my body, it drops. Ooh, I can't take my eyes off of it. Been so phenomenally.
Fun? Yes. Danceable? Yes. Cheap ripoff of what Pharrell did organically and magically one or two summers ago?
Hell yes.
Yes. This song is good. I have danced to this song at weddings. It has already made itself into the rotation and I believe will stay there for some time. I cannot love it. Am I wrong?
I think it's thorough B-team. B-team.
Why?
It just does not have the true legs of a summer jam. Yeah. Of like top tier summer jam.
I mean, the thing is kind of what I want from a summer jam is to also reach that sort of like height of emotion, to just like have those moments of like where the falsetto just gets you, or, you mm-hmm. know, where the steaminess of Demi Lovato overwhelms me and I have to grab the wall.
Yes.
And I feel
and
like
that just ain't happening here.
It's not happening here. He's no Pharrell. Wonderful in his way.
Really, the Kia gerbils are way up in this song.
What
this
do you mean?
Kia hamsters. This is a Kia hamster scenario like no other.
What does that mean?
That means that more than anything of the song choices you've ever provided, this is a full-on Kia
commercial.
Kia commercial.
Yeah.
Which is not a compliment, I believe.
Look, I love him and I love everything he does, but this song is so egregious in its copycatting of Pharrell that it's like, why would you even go there?
And
he must have gotten an okay from Pharrell to just go ahead and do it.
I also deeply feel that it was originally called Can't Stop the Music, and then they realized that that was a movie starring the Village People
and Bruce Jenner.
Pre-transition Caitlyn Jenner.
Right.
And we're like, we can't do that. Have to make it Can't Stop the Feeling?
Yeah.
Oliver, thoughts?
It's okay. I would play. I'm DJing a wedding this weekend. Would I consider playing it at said wedding? Yeah, probably. It's inoffensive.
But you
it's
wouldn't
fun.
Try to like do anything with that song. You just put that in the middle of some set.
Right.
Will you play a certain DNCE song?
Who?
Or will you play Cake by the Ocean?
You know, I haven't listened to it yet.
You haven't listened to Cake by How have you missed it?
All right, let's leave this for Summer Jam formal discussion. Oliver.
Yeah.
What's your jam?
So I'm going to backspin or take things back to where I began, which was I was in D.C. for 4 days at the Smithsonian Folk-like Festival. And part of what I was brought out there to do was to moderate a series of panels called the Filipino-American Soundscapes, which featured artist Lowleaf, who I have spoken about before, and one of her songs was one of my jams. She's great. Live, I mean, she was a freaking amazing live. But the other artist was Bamboo, who is a rapper originally from L.A. He lives up in the Bay Area now. And I think I probably was – I moderated at least 9 panels that he was on. And one song that he performed, I think I probably heard at least 6 times, to the extent that this one song, this one part of this one song is now a freaking earworm, is from his last album called Party Worker, which came out last year. It's a song called Check In. And specifically the hook, I cannot get out of my goddamn head now. So I've been good just being a dad who rap on the weekend.
Happy to be here with all of my comrades. They call me Bamboo, that be stolen right out of Killer, California, and the Philippines is where my fam from. And I ain't come to bother nobody. You fuck up somebody party, but don't test me. The scrap is in my blood.
Yeah, this whole thing.
Has he ever sang with the song?
I don't
before?
Think he's
That's
ever sung. Unprecedented. I'm like, is he drunk? What's happening? He doesn't drink, though, so that can't be it. He's just so moved. He can't stop the feeling.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, we have to get Oliver out of here because he's drunk.
Drunk on soul.
On beats. You guys, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winner Mitchell, Margaret Wampler, and Oliver Webb. And for those of you who haven't already purchased Margaret's novel, Neon Green is now available. You can get it anywhere. She says that you should get it in an indie bookstore. I think you should get it at Amazon and have it brought to your home and also increase your numbers on Neon Green. But... I've read it, and it's a fucking good book. It is really, really fun. You guys will enjoy it. So get it. We post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links in the episode description of the podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to This Is Not There and Jeff Masters 1 for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Also, more of you review us. This is not okay. If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We are at PopRocket. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the well-coiffed Christian Duenas and Colin Anderson.
Who's never here.
Broken up about Brexit.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.